Well, I'll have to say that they couldn't have, if they had to train up this way, they couldn't have picked a much better place. And had a beautiful field house there. It would take a, we had a full-size infield with a dirt floor. We had two batting cages with a regular pitching distance.
Oh, that's great.
And that only took up, I'd say, about a half. Of course, when the infield was in action, having infield practice and things like that, it took up a little more than half. Mm-hmm. But it still gave plenty of room for players to do other things, bunting games and things like that. And when the days were right, we went outside on the regular playing field. And one of the first things that happened there, we sent the Cincinnati Club sent their groundkeeper over to the baseball field to see what he could do to shine it up a little bit, smooth it out. And at that time, they were pitching from a flat surface. They didn't have any pitching mound. And one of the first things that Matty Schwab did, our groundkeeper, was to build a pitching mound so we could have that slope that a pitcher needs. And somebody saw him emptying all that dirt in the middle of the ball diamond, and they ran into the coach and wondered what was going on. Yeah. And it was through that, through the our groundkeeper working outside when we were inside, and the University of Indiana baseball team came out to work out while we weren't out there. And he saw this one big fellow hitting a ball a mile. And naturally, he turned his name into the management, and it turned out to be Ted Kluszewski. Mm. And Ted, at that time, I'm given to understand, didn't have much interest in baseball except that it was something to do in the spring of the year. And of course, the rest everybody knows about. All he could do was hit a ball. He didn't know where to play him, but first base and outfield. He was an outfielder at the time. But over the years, after the Reds signed him, they eventually wound up at first base, which I thought was quite a story in itself right there.
Right, because I guess he was doing well as a football player, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. That, Indiana had great football teams. In fact, they had one of their football players played here with the Eagles for a long time, Pete Pijos. And, of course, things weren't the same. We had two workouts a day and had the box lunches at the clubhouse, and certainly wasn't anything like Florida, but it was the best there was. It was just like the baseball at the time. It was the only game in town, so
right.
What do you got to complain about?
Now, in the evening, did you all stay in the... Did you all eat dinner together? I mean, was it like the training table?
Well, not particularly. We had the usual thing, you sign checks. They had a limit, like, say, for 2 or 3 hours or so. The dining room was open, and there wasn't any training table. But, in fact, I don't think we ever had one of those in baseball that I can remember. Mm-hmm. And you're more or less on your own.
Did you live in a dormitory or a hotel?
No, we lived in a hotel in Bloomington. It was a good hotel.
Mm-hmm. Was it within walking distance of the field, or did you in the field house, or did you have to take a bus every morning?
No, we got there the best way we could. It wasn't that far, really. Mm-hmm. You could catch a ride, or there was enough automobiles around. If fellas had there, you could always hitch a ride.
What about travel restrictions? Do you have any interesting stories about train rides or food and gas rationing during the war?
Well, everybody had to go through the gas stamps and all. I didn't have my family with me during the war years in Cincinnati, and I didn't have a car. I lived downtown and used public transportation. Of course, the traveling, which used to be of a very high quality, and we didn't ride airplanes in those days because it wasn't necessary. But the service gradually slacked off, like everything else, and it was still good. It was still good. But then they started, trains started to get filled up, and there was more travelers going back and forth, and it just wasn't as pleasant as it was before.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't guaranteed of a Pullman, necessarily?
Well, the ball clubs were, because they, at that time they were still running even special trains if they had to, but then that, even that was cut out.
Mm-hmm.
And we always had two or three Pullman cars, and usually no less than two. And sometimes when it was required, they'd put a special dining car on for you for a certain distance. And it was as the years went by in 44, 45, and 46, the service just went, you know, completely downhill. But we didn't have too big a problem. We didn't have any night ball at the time, so it wasn't any problem in making like a jump from Philadelphia to Pittsburgh or Philadelphia to Boston, short hops like that.
Are you saying no night ball? I thought that Cincinnati was the first.
Well, we played some, but we didn't play every night.
Yeah.
And when night baseball first started, they usually played a night game and the next day would be off.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, there were some restrictions on the night games, too. I remember in New York, they had second thoughts on playing night games there. I remember an All-Star game, that was 1944, somewhere in there, that I believe they allowed them to play at night.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really a little hazy on that subject. But there wasn't that much night ball at the time. And you know, we're still talking about traveling, so we didn't have any problems making the night sleeper jumps.
Mm-hmm.
And then when night ball came in, it was impossible to make these trains, and they wouldn't hold them that long for you. Usually they used to do that. If you're going to be an hour late, they'd hold the train.
Oh, I see.
And but as night games went on and on, time was dragging on while you couldn't make those.
Mm-hmm.
Can you shut that off?
In 1943, Ray Mueller, the catcher, began a National League record by catching in 233 consecutive games. Do you remember anything specific about it? I mean, did he come close to losing the record or having the streak broken due to injury or something like that?
Well, I imagine Ray caught many a game where he wasn't, you know, really shouldn't have been catching.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a durable guy, and he loved baseball,
mm-hmm.
and he's still in it, by the way.
He's going to give me an interview.
And he was a good, loyal fella, and whoever he worked for always held him in the highest regard. And Ray wasn't an outstanding hitter, but he wasn't an easy out, and he could hit a long ball for you now and then, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a big league catcher. Even though he had came up from Sacramento during the war, Ray was one of the best catchers I ever pitched to.
Now, I know that he had a few false starts. I think he was up in the middle 30s.
He came up very young with the Boston Braves,
mm-hmm.
and like I say, he caught him many a time when the average guy wouldn't have been would have begged off,
mm-hmm.
and. He had good tools, right? He was a good receiver, had a good arm, and he knew hitters.
Mm-hmm.
He was a big league catcher, right? He wasn't just a wartime catcher, if that's what you're asking.
No, I knew that. He stuck around before and after. In 1942, I've read, Frank Graham had an article in Sports Illustrated 4 or 5 years ago, which said that immediately after the 1942 All-Star Game ended in the Polo Grounds, that a near panic ensued because they suddenly had an air raid drill. Do you remember that at all?
I don't remember the air raid drill. 42,
or
I don't know.
Or something, but something happened just as the game ended. And apparently the fans made a mad dash for the exits. Do you recall that at all?
No, I don't. It could have happened like after we were in the clubhouse or something, after the game was over. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether I was on that team or not, to tell you the truth.
Yes, you pitched in that game. That's when Boudreau and York hit homers for
that's right.
them, and Yellen hit one for you.
That's right. And I don't recall that, but it would have been a good time to have an air raid drill. everybody to make everybody conscious, because at that time people along the East Coast were pretty conscious of things happening, you know. But I don't recall that. I can't remember.
Okay.
Can't remember.
In 1944, April 26th to be exact, you won your first daylight game at Crosley Field since September 42. It was a 13-inning affair, and Frank McCormick won it for you with a homer, 1-0. Was this just a coincidence that you had trouble winning during the daytime in Crosley Field?
I don't know. they always say things like that. It was opening day. Usually Cincinnati makes an event out of their opening days, and the park is pretty much sold out as far as advance sale by Christmas time the previous year, and they give them away as Christmas presents and all that. They've done this for many, many years there, way back. And as a result, in the old park, they used to have temporary seats from foul pole to foul pole in the outfield. And of course, it shortened up the field quite a bit too.
Mm-hmm.
And since they used to have a little terrace about 25 or 30 feet down from the wall, and it sloped up towards the fences, and that's where they would put these seats.
Now, was this just for opening day?
This was just opening day. It's just for that. And Cincinnati usually opened at home.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this had nothing to do with winning and losing, because it evens up for both clubs.
Yeah.
I never attached anything to it. I mean, whether you were good that day or I don't know.
Do you even remember it? Were you aware that you won a whole season without winning during the daytime in your home park?
Me in particular?
Pardon?
Me in particular,
yes.
You mean?
Right. In other words, you did not win at Crosley Field during the daytime for all of 1943. You went from September 42 to April of 44 without winning a ball game during the daytime at Crosley Field.
You're talking about me in particular?
Yeah, you in particular. No, I'm not talking about the club.
No, gee, I didn't know that. I never heard that one before. I'd have to check that out.
It's a minor item I dredged up from a periodical from 1945 telling about the 44 season.
The
Whitman Bell Baseball Annual.
I don't know. I wish that book I had shown you, Mr. Moses Poems, had that in there. That would sure. Gee whiz, I don't know about that.
Yeah, I'm talking about you specifically now. I'm not talking about the club as a whole.
I had no idea.
Okay.
I had no idea.
Okay, now we're talking the same year now, only May of 44. You pitched a one-hitter against the Braves, and Clyde Schoen no-hit them the next
That's
day.
That's right.
Do you remember that? Anything specific?
Well, I don't know. I think there was a lot of complaint about having such a dead ball at the time that I had trouble hitting it out of the infield, let alone out of the park. But I remember the games very well. I think Jim Tobin at that time, who was involved in one or two of those games, he had pitched a couple of no-hitters that year.
Right. I think he was the victim of Schoen's no-hitter, and yet he pitched two himself that year, won a five-inning job against the Phils, and one in Brooklyn early in the season.
If I remember Schoen's no-hitter, I'd pitch a one-hitter the day before or something. I can remember that game. I had two outs in the ninth inning with Connie Ryan at bat, and I had pitched him outside practically all day.
Yeah.
And if I ever thought there was a time to bust one in on his fist, it was a time, and I got it exactly where I wanted, and he hit it about an inch from his fist and just got over the third baseman's head, and that was the only hit of the game.
Gee whiz. And this was with two out in the ninth?
Yeah.
That's something. You just popped one, huh? Right over the third baseman's head. Now let's move on to June of 44. That's when Joe Nuxhall made his appearance.
That game, too.
To you as a veteran, what was going through your mind when you saw this big 15-year-old youngster out in the middle?
Oh, Joe was such a big, likable guy that no matter what he did, the game was lost. And I guess McKechnie figured it was as good a time to break him in and let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a tremendous score, if I remember.
Yeah, 18-0 at the finish.
And Joe was just out there with that big smile on his face, and I can remember McKechnie hollering, "Close your eyes and let it go, Joe." and those cardinal batters were turning around and looking over at the fence, and there was nothing mean about it. You know,
sure.
It was meant. It was
just psyching them out.
And then I think that the Joe, after he, I guess he was in some more ball games, but I think he went back to high school after that.
He did. Got his amateur status back.
And Joe was always a big, good-natured kid, you know, and he could throw the ball pretty good at that time. Then later on, he smartened up and learned how to pitch. He got to be a pretty good pitcher.
So you and McCormick and the other veterans didn't resent the fact that he was on the ball club at 15 years of age?
Absolutely not. We had some fellas, I remember in spring training one year, that were three times as old as Joe. Nobody resented that. We had a fellow, Hod Lissenby, and and Guy Bush and Waller Beck, who had, I think a couple of them had been retired for two or three years, hadn't thrown a ball, but they were still, you know, knew what it was about, and you had to fill your roster up. In fact, Hod Lissenby, in one of the games, I don't know, it was 45 or somewhere in there, I had started the game in Cincinnati, and Pittsburgh rallied and tied it up. And Lissenby went in and relieved. And we had an outfielder named Dane Clay.
Mm-hmm.